Okay. Representative Winsor. People who are first on the agenda, the author of the first on the agenda is not here. We're going to start with your bill. Which you said, so we have a plan.
Oh, I think you made it.
Oh, okay. You didn't move fast enough, so you get.
I'll just make it grow.
Okay, Madam Speaker, we're about to displace you, but okay. Okay.
I left as quickly as I could. Madam Chair, I have to darken your door again this year, so thank you for your consideration. We are before you today with the bill that would invest in one of Minnesota's great cultural jewels, as well as one of the premier public places in Minnesota, the surrounding area of TD Plaza. The Minnesota Orchestra has been winning terrific acclaim through its many international tours, and it also has been touring the state of Minnesota as well. During its 2006 European tour, the London Times wrote, "Out of nowhere, it seems, the world has acquired a new superstar band with a maestro to match." The orchestra has developed a similar outstanding global reputation for the quality of its recordings. And the New Yorker recently proclaimed the Minnesota Orchestra's Beethoven recordings some of the most vivid Beethoven playing on the market. And yet, for all of this international acclaim and its reputation, the Minnesota Orchestra is rooted firmly right here in our community. Most of the musicians live and work right here in our community. The orchestra annually, and has for a very long time, toured all around the state. It offers education programs for over 80,000 Minnesota students, and it performs 200 concerts a year, most of which are held at Orchestra Hall, and this renovation is important to the music venue, and that is our topic today. Before I introduce you to the chairman of the orchestra board, who is with me here today to help present the bill, I want to mention that on a personal note, last week I had the pleasure of being at Orchestra Hall. My children, who are 13 and 10, were performing at Orchestra Hall as part of our church, actually. And this is a really interesting collaboration that has happened between the orchestra and the Basilica of St. Mary. And that is the performance of, 2 years ago, a world premiere oratorio that commemorates the children of the Holocaust. And this piece had, I think, over 300 voices performing and over 200 musicians. So it was quite spectacular and was actually played last Friday night on MCR on the Classical Station. And I will just tell you the impact that this has had on my own children. I have a 13-year-old son, and all of you who know what 13-year-old boys are like, he's a happy hockey player and goalie. But he also has been really enticed by this piece, this particular piece, to stay in his church choir and be able to participate in what was the recording of this piece for the first time in the world. And I got to actually experience a little bit of that with the Swedish recording label that is here, recording the orchestra and these voices. And it was truly an amazing and incredible experience to be able to see these are not professional singers who are singing with the orchestra on this particular piece. And it was absolutely incredible. My kids have participated over the years in the music outreach that the orchestra does with 80,000 kids. They've been two of those 80,000 kids. I think that the jewel that this provides, and one of the things that I was struck by when I toured the orchestra 2 years ago was that this is a world-class orchestra, and frankly, the facility is less than world-class. I was amazed that we are able to attract and keep the likes of the musicians we have, and Osmo Vanska as well, being able to attract Osmo into our space. It is also, to me, the other piece of this is the public piece of this, which is the experience of PV Plaza, which is a public park, and it is integral to the block that Orchestra Hall is on. And so this money that we are looking for today is really about planning into the future, the interaction and the public work that will go on with Orchestra Hall and PV Plaza. And with that, I'd like to introduce to you, and it's my great pleasure to introduce to you, the chairman of the Orchestra Board, Jack Huster.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jack Huster, and as the speaker indicated, I'm chairman of the board of the Minnesota Orchestra. I also had a nice experience last week. I got to listen to some of that recording going on, and I got to talk to Mike O'Connell from the Basilica about the support he's given and the support and fun it's been for the Basilica. So it was really kind of a neat experience. Let me just tell you a little bit about the orchestra, but the speaker has put much of this on the table already. This is a top orchestra in the United States right now. It's one of the best. But this orchestra and its musical leadership and the staff really are earnestly aspiring to be one of the best orchestras in the world. And trips that they've taken to Royal Albert Hall and the Proms in London and throughout Europe, and a concert each year at Carnegie Hall, and one upcoming here in April at Avery Fisher Hall in New York, all go to support that and lead to some of the kind of headlines that the speaker read. The orchestra was founded in 1903, and only 4 years later began to go out to the outstate areas of Minnesota, the greater Minnesota areas, and this is probably the one arts organization in the Twin Cities area that has a regular outreach outside of the Twin Cities. In fact, I'm excited myself because tomorrow I'm going to Jackson, Minnesota to introduce the orchestra in Jackson and the following night in Marshall. And that's going to be a thrill for me. I like to go out there pheasant hunting, but it's great to go out and take this wonderful orchestra and the wonderful music along. The orchestra performs over 200 concerts a year in various places, mostly at Orchestra Hall, but in all kinds of cities and venues, churches and amphitheaters and so forth. They're heard by 400,000 people in those concerts in a single year. With many, many more, 200,000 over the local radio broadcast regionally, and we broadcast also nationally on national public radio, and one only can guess how many millions of people have heard the Minnesota Orchestra. But it is the Minnesota Orchestra, and that's what takes us out beyond the Twin Cities. On the financial front, we just finished the year with a balanced budget that had a $30 million budget and balanced it, and that's a big feat for any organization. It certainly is for orchestras throughout this country. It's a golden period for this orchestra. It's a golden period for the Orchestral Association and Orchestra Hall. But now we're building and rebuilding our hall and our public areas for the future, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit here. So today we're requesting $3 million of planning money to help us along the road of figuring out exactly what we need and being able to present it to donors, and in 2 years come back and present a request for a $30 million bonding. But now, this year, we're asking for $3 million. Let me talk about the project briefly. The Orchestra Hall, and this is really two things. It's the hall where the music is played, and it's a very good hall. It needs some things to be modernized, but it's a very good hall. But everything around it didn't get much of the money to build it. It cost $15 million to build in 1974, but the lobby was undersized, and built with very inexpensive materials. I think maybe they thought it would fall down by now. It hasn't, but it's trying. So our purpose here then is to do the planning for a four-focus redo of our facilities. The first focus is to expand the lobby, probably doubling its size. An interesting statistic for me is that during a sold-out concert, we have approximately 6 square feet per person during intermission. That's all, and that is usable. And that means that it really isn't usable. So we would like to double the size of that lobby. In addition to serving the needs of our audience, this expansion will serve the needs of our educational programs. As the speaker indicated, we've had over 80,000 students visit Orchestra Hall in this last year, but we have very, very little space to work with them. So we want to increase those numbers and the depth of those programs. The second part of it is a modernization of the hall itself. The hall has great acoustics and it stood the test of time. But things have changed since 1974. One needs to have the ability to deal with amplified music. One needs to have the ability to bring screens up so that everybody in the hall can see the maestro, can see the orchestra, just as you would have it at any concert. We need to be able to hear each other on stage. I say we, and that's not quite fair, because I can't even begin to play any instrument like those people do. But they need to hear each other, and they need to hear themselves. And we don't have the right electronic equipment and acoustical experience on stage to do that. So we look forward to doing that as well. We need to renovate the backstage. There are virtually no practice rooms and no rooms to work with children like yours on instruments or vocals or whatever it might be. So, and we have some very fine instruments, and we have no place to store them, and they're kind of piled up. And when you think about the cost of those instruments, that is very strange. So the backstage needs a full renovation. And the fourth piece of this is PV Plaza. Minneapolis owns PV Plaza, but we work together and hope to work together on this project to revitalize PV Plaza, keep it as the center for our Summerfest, as it has been, but have it work better for sort of a connection with the hall itself. PV Plaza sits in, and the Orchestra Hall sit in a very interesting place. We're near most of the restaurants. We're in a place where the high-rises don't rise too high right around us. In the western little part of downtown Minneapolis, we have the convention hall very nearby. So it's a very important place. So anyway, that's what we're trying to do. And one of the things that I find interesting is the enthusiasm that our orchestra players have for this project. They are so excited about looking forward to the things we can do, as is Osmo Vanska. And we really believe that their love for the music, their skill with the music, it's just thrilling to watch Osmo do a rehearsal with his orchestra. They are so responsive. And they love living here. They love this place, as we all do in this community. So we want to make it just a great orchestra hall that can serve very well. And we'd ask you to support this $3 million bonding bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think there's an amendment that I need.
Yes.
Someone to move
the amendment. Okay. Right. I'll move the amendment on A1 amendment, delete employment and economic development, and insert administration. Decided you'd rather deal with Commissioner Badgero than Commissioner Swigum.
No, it's not so much who the commissioner is. We did a retrospective of where these sorts of bills usually found their fiscal agent, and more often than not, it's actually the Department of Administration and not Deed. So I wouldn't mind either. I think either would be fine, but I think we're going to try to keep the consistency of going to the Department of Administration.
Yes. Okay. Actually, since for the bonding bill, we're not really passing bills, I think we can just, without objection, consider this change in the bill has been made. We didn't move the bill, so we don't need to move the amendment. I do have one question, looking at some of the ways that we're doing limits and the limits on our bonding bill. Do you know what the credit rating of the city of Minneapolis is at this time? And has there ever been any thought that the city of Minneapolis might be the funding agent for this?
I think that I don't know what the credit rating is. I don't know if anyone in the room does it, could come and help me with that. But I think from my understanding of the limited bonding capacity that the city of Minneapolis has, it is spoken for by, frankly, renovation and overlays of streets right now and the other capital costs related to sort of very basic costs within the city. And I think that is fairly typical for a lot of cities, as well as the issues with the convention center and Target Center.
Okay.
We can get that for you, Madam
Chair. Okay, good. Are there any other... Are there any questions? Representative?
Yes, Madam Chair and Madam Speaker. I'm just wondering, for the Minneapolis project, where would you, of bonding projects, where would you rate this in your priority list for the Minneapolis project, roughly?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Pepin, the interesting part of this is the city has their own list, and I think the city supports the project, but this may not be one of their priority projects. However, this is in my district, and so I would rate this project very highly on my own list. So I think it's always a careful thing when we're working with our municipalities, and I know their number one project is debt relief on the Target Center, much as the St. Paul project. Their number one project is debt relief on River Center.
What number of on the city's list would this be then? Is there?
I think it's on the support list. What they do is they do a prioritized list, and then they do projects they support. And so they support a lot of cross-jurisdictional projects, including this sort of project. Although I, you know, yep.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Speaker, I think you had mentioned in your presentation coming back to the legislature for $30 million. Is it then going to be $60 million total, so the city's going to put up another $30 million, or do you have any idea what the total cost will be of the project overall?
Actually, thank you, Representative Anderson. I think that, and Madam Chair, that a lot of the match will be handled by private fundraising, as has happened on many of these projects. The city is very interested in the work around TV Plaza, and is I think we'll be in discussion with them about the TV Plaza side of things. And if you, the next time you're downtown Minneapolis and you drive by this, you can see just how interrelated this is, because the building actually hangs out over TV Plaza a little bit, and so it's very much a connected piece. And what we would see is that there would be a lot of private funds raised for this project, much as happened on other cultural projects like this that are important to the state. And then I'm sure there will be some participation with the city on the public side of it, the TV Plaza side of it.
Madam Speaker, if I may add something to that, and Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, just for clarity, we're asking for $3 million for planning purposes now. We'll come back in 2010 with approximately a $30 million request, and the total project will be $90 million. So two-thirds of that, roughly, would be raised from private donors and corporations and the like. That's helpful.
Okay. No further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Winslow, how fast can you do this?
How fast can I be?
Yes.
As fast as the members of the committee permit.
Okay. Now, he can move with the second member of the committee. We have it. Okay. This bill came kind of quickly from its last committee, so you don't have the history before it, but Mr. Shepard assures us that it's a real legal document and we can act on it. Representative Inclus, first, do you want to move?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe the motion would be to recommend that House File 2553 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. We have the motion is before us. Okay.
Madam Chair.
The bill is now before us.
So. Pardon?
The bill is now before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment. It is the A-10 amendment. It addresses a number of different aspects of the bill, and I would like, if possible, to do a couple of oral amendments to the amendment, or I think that would be the correct posture, before we take on the full amendment.
Okay. Would you go ahead and tell us?
Referring to the A-10 amendment, lines 1.10 and 1.11, I would delete both of those lines. Referring to line 2.9, and Mr. Shepherd, I think, or I hope, can help me with this. I would like to amend the amendment so that it states not September 1st and then 2008, which I think is written in the bill draft, but rather September 1st, 2009.
I'm sorry, which line?
2.1.
Oh, okay.
And then I believe that we need to insert a line between 2.3 and 2.4. Mr. Shepherd, I think, has language there, but that will, when the amendment is completed, it will state that the appropriation is available until June 30th, 2011, rather than until spent.
Okay. Everyone understands those, will allow the author to incorporate them within.
I actually have one more.
Sorry. Okay.
And then in addition, on line 2.9, the last word of that sentence is spent. I would change that to until June 30th, 2011. And finally, I don't know if Mr. Shepherd's had a chance to add an additional sentence to the amendment, probably after line 2.12, but I would refer to him on that.
Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, there would be a new sentence that would require reporting of this Pillsbury United Communities grant to the Senate Finance and House Ways and Means Committees, and the sentence would read, after the period on line 12, Pillsbury United Communities must report to the chairs of the Senate Finance and House Ways and Means Committees by July 1, 2008, 2009, and 2010 on expenditure of money under this subdivision. I do have that written down. That I can.
And with those minor oral amendments to the amendment.
Okay, I think that's pretty understandable.
Urge your
And we'll allow so that the author will then incorporate those oral amendments into the A-10 amendment, and he's now moved the A-10 amendment with the oral amendment added. Any questions on the A-10 amendment?
You're hanging out with Len too much.
What?
How many times do you say amendment?
Madam Chair, I'll just briefly go through these. Go through the provisions of the amendment. Lines 1.2 through 1.6 changes the legislative finding at the beginning of Article 1 to more clearly define when a catastrophe fund could be invoked in the future. Again, it's still subject to a legislative decision to do so, but the language now at least refers to an event that in some way goes to the very core of what government is supposed to do in Minnesota, and that is to provide for public safety for its people. Line 1.7 is a technical amendment. Lines 1.8 and 1.9 refer to the reporting of the special master under the current version of the bill. The report is simply to the Attorney General. This expands it so that the report on administrative expenses would also be made to the legislature. And that was in response to some members' request at some point along the line here. I would 1.12 really through the end of the first page are really all I would call technical legal amendments that don't change the substance of the bill in any way. Line 2.1, the date there represents the deadline by which survivors would have to submit a claim or an application for compensation to the fund, And that is 2 years, over 2 years from the date of the bridge collapse. But for certain kinds of medical conditions, that's an appropriate amount of time by which physicians can determine likely future disability. So that is doesn't in any way prohibit survivors from applying for funds immediately if they are prepared to do so, but it gives them a window of time if their injuries would so warrant a longer period. There is an appropriation now for the bill, and that's line 2.3. The number is $39,320,000. And that number, I would expect, is what the chairs of the Finance and Ways and Means Committee intend to move through their committees and send to the House floor as well.
And I totally believe that it's correct to say that that's a line that's also been discussed with the governor's office.
With the governor's office, correct. And the Department of Finance.
Yeah.
And then the new line of regarding June 30th, 2011, that was a request from the Finance and Ways and Means Chairs to include a date by which the funds have to be expended. If there's money left, we can take it out of the fund. If it's all gone, it's gone. Or if the date needs to be extended, we can do that. But it creates a date certain by which it should be completed. And then finally, lines 2.5 through 2.12 are the correction to the Wade House grant that was in the bill language originally. And this is in response to an amendment that I know Representatives De La Forest and Zellers were interested in, and it provides a bit more accountability for how those funds would be expended. I don't have it with me, but representatives from Wade House are here, and they do have a three-year business plan for addressing the needs of these kids, and the amounts that are represented in that amendment tie directly to their programmatic needs, and it's based on a three-year cycle for a three-year period, and we get reports back on how they've expended the money and to find out whether or not they're doing what they said they were going to be doing. Just some basic accountability is the goal. I did that in order to try to address what I thought was the likely intent of the amendment that Representative Zellers and De La Forest were going to offer, and I did talk to Representative Zellers previously about it. And that is the substance of the amendment.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment? What? Representative Horton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if it's a question on the amendment or a question on the bill. I'm just wondering, is there a cap per claimant? I'm hoping the answer is no.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, regardless of what the question was to, the answer is no.
Okay. The amendment is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. I know we've seen the bill before, and a lot of people have seen Representative De La Forest says he's seen it more times than he's seen his family. So, do you want to give some recap of any changes since you last saw it? Or
I couldn't, Madam Chair, I couldn't begin to remember what you last saw and what specifically has changed since that last hearing. The substance is largely the same. There are two sections of the bill. Article 1 is a general concept and statute that's established for a catastrophe survivor fund that could be invoked in the future if the legislature and the governor decide that an event has occurred that would merit this type of extraordinary relief to be granted. Interestingly, in the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee this morning, we had a bill from Representative Pawlowski representing a more formalized structure that the state would use to deal with natural disasters. And actually, I think the bills line up. This is a highly unusual kind of event that we're dealing with the bridge collapse, and so I would not anticipate that this catastrophe compensation fund would ever be used until such, you know, such an unusual event would occur again. And it does, however, leave that definition in statute so that we would be prepared if it was ever needed. Again, the fund would be created would not provide for punitive damages or attorney fees, which is one change we've made. To clarify, no attorney fees will be paid out of funds that survivors receives. There is an executive, or I'm sorry, there's a special master who I think is also changed since we last heard this, appointed by the executive council of the state, the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, state auditor, and attorney general. That was in response to, I think, a suggestion from Representative De La Forest. There's a 1% cap on the administrative expenses that can be devoted to the fund. So out of the $39 million appropriation, I think that comes out at about $390,000. We now have a date in our amendment by which claims have to be filed. But in general, it's 30 days. This executive council has 30 days to appoint a special master. And after the special master receives an application for compensation, they would have 120 days to respond. And then at that point, the survivor would have 30 days to decide whether they would accept the proposed compensation amount. And if so, they would sign a release to the state of Minnesota. We've revised the type of release. I don't think that's probably an issue for this committee. We also have amended the bill in Commerce yesterday on the subrogation issue, giving anybody, any insurance entity that would have, any ERISA-type insurance entity that would have a subrogation claim to make, giving them 60 days to assert it. And if they don't assert it within that 60 days, they would waive it. The state would hold on to the compensation award for that 60-day period, and if the claim was made, then the compensation amount would be held back for further consideration. And that essentially is an opportunity to negotiate the outcome for the survivor. The state can pursue its own interest against third parties related to the bridge collapse. No admission on liability. We're not affecting in any way the state's liability cap. The fund can receive gifts from third parties, and it's effective immediately. Article 2 is specific to 35W. One definition I think we've always had is that you had to have been on the bridge to receive any kind of benefits. And finally, we discussed Wade House a bit, but short of that, we also specify that the emergency relief payments that were set up this past fall will stop once this bill is passed and funds become available. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Wilson.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Winkler, thank you. I'm sure the bill of this magnitude, you're being badgered from all quarters with the Goldilocks treatment. Every time you change the bill, there are folks who think your bill is now too hot or too cold, and probably very few who think it's just right. But I'm appreciative of all the work you have done. But I did want to just articulate one thought I hope you'll keep in mind moving forward, and that is with this idea of moving forward and creating a long-lasting structure as opposed to dealing with just the events regarding the bridge collapse. I'm a little bit concerned, and I know it's been bipartisan. I know Representative Paymar has brought up some of the same concerns, that essentially we've got some rather subjective criteria about defining a catastrophe moving forward. And one thing we certainly won't do is take the politics out of this place. And I know members on both sides of the aisle have had a concern moving forward that future claims or future declarations of catastrophe may be based more on politics than an actual policy, based upon seniority and the like. And so I hope simply as you move forward that you'll give some more careful consideration to perhaps limiting it to just this event, or even perhaps putting in some type of objective criteria to guide the legislature in declaring a catastrophe in the future. Thanks.
Well, if I can do a first hit at that answer. The question is, had we had something in place like this, we would have given a lot of relief to a lot of people right away. And the psychological trauma that people in that incident went through was just incredible. And just to be able to point to a structure, mm-hmm. and it's pretty clear that you don't do it unless you have the agreement of the governor and the legislature. You know, it doesn't kick in until Article 2 kicks in. And the final thing is, I think the fact that we've done it for this event and the things that we referred to in the discussion about this, like the 9/11 incident, like the incident in the incidents of the two bridges collapsing in California and so forth, I think sets a pretty clear set of parameters by example of what we consider to be a catastrophe. And
Madam Chair, I certainly agree with you. With a part-time legislature, there may be very well be some merit in establishing an ongoing structure. that will have some agility. There's no doubt we had a very difficult time fashioning a response to what happened. But as I said, I just share a concern that, and it isn't a reflection of any partisanship. I've been here three terms, and we've seen the majority and the minority switch around. I just have a concern that going forward, I'm the Speaker of the House, so I've got a catastrophe, and you're a junior member of the minority, so you don't have a catastrophe. And I just have a concern about that moving forward. And, you know, like you said, I understand reasonable minds can certainly differ regarding that viewpoint, but it is my hope that maybe some objective criteria, nonetheless, may be inserted at some point to help guide the legislature, whether that's a dollar amount or something. I don't know.
I think,
Madam Chair, Representative LaForce, it may give you some comfort in that regard, that to know that I don't believe that the Senate bill is structured in this way. So this will be something that will have to be sorted out at some point. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wharton. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry if you said it before I got here, but who is the executive council?
Oh. Madam Chair, Representative Portman, it's the Governor, Lieutenant Governor, Attorney General, State Auditor, and Secretary of State.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I'm just a little concerned about the cap on the administrative fee. I mean, $390,000 to administer $39 million, right? This is a complicated set of circumstances with a lot of different people affected. Do you feel comfortable that that's going to provide the money that's needed to adequately value these claims?
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, I think that that likely is adequate. I mean, I don't think that the person who would be appointed special master would be doing this to run up fees at a law firm. And you can do a lot of work on an hourly basis with that amount of money, and I don't think it would require a huge amount of administrative staff to do it either.
And the other point is that's why we meet in annual sessions. We can always adjust that if we need to.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I just had in mind the idea of the use of experts in terms of rehabilitation experts and medical experts and determining really what type of funds would be adequate to restore a person in the way that we're hoping to, or compensate a person in the way that we're hoping to. I know those are complex analyses that aren't always done by lawyers, but are done by other experts that the fund would have to retain to make sure they're giving the right amount to the right people.
And Madam Chair, Representative Portman, if you have specific ideas that would you think be better, we have still, even after today, we have two more committee stops, the House Floor Conference Committee, to address some of these things. In part, it's you know, in significant part anyway, it's a indication that we're not going to be spending money on administration. We're not going to be spending money on attorney's fees. We're trying to get aid to the survivors to the maximum degree possible. And if that's impractical on 1%, I'd be interested in hearing more about that.
Any other questions? Okay. Representative Winkler renews his motion that House File 2553 be recommended to pass and move to the Finance Committee. Well, as amended.
Thank you,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I'll get this straight. Got it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Just 1 minute. Representative Ward moves the minutes of February 14th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Meeting adjourned. Thank you so much for being quiet.